From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, John Wesley Powell. He was the gritty, one-armed explorer and scientist who first navigated the Colorado River in 1869. As you know, he made it, barely, and the historian John Ross says it deeply changed him. Ross has a new book about Powell, about how the experience made him realize the West is limited by its water, but it's a message almost no one wanted to hear. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Wesley Powell was restless, full of ideas, and just on fire with curiosity about the way the world worked. We know about Powell because of his remarkable and kind of crazy expedition of the Grand Canyon where he navigated the Colorado River in 1869. It made him famous because he had no idea what he was getting himself into. He barely made it out alive, and he did it with just one arm. He had lost it in the Civil War. And Powell was kind of a rock star when he was asked to talk to Congress about what he had learned. The historian John Ross has a new book, and he explains that what Powell had learned in that canyon was just how much the Earth had been in flux, how old it was, how humans had only been in the picture for a fraction of time, and also this, how dry the West was. And so he told them. And it was exactly what they didn't want to hear. They wanted to hear Powell reassure them the West could be settled, that it could be watered and made green and productive. Now, John Wesley Powell believed in manifest destiny just as much as the next guy, but he learned that if Americans were going to succeed in this part of the country, they were going to have to change their expectations and limit their ideas about growth. Today in the program, John Ross is joining us to talk about John Wesley Powell. His new book is The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. John Ross is an historian and writer. He's a former editor of American Heritage magazine. He joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington.
As a child, I read his journals going down the Colorado River, and it's so exciting. And it really, as a child, it really just grabbed me. And later on in my life, when I went down rivers as he did, that nobody had gone down before, I felt him perched on my shoulder. And then I ended up working at the Smithsonian Institution and tripping over his work with Indians and in ethnology and anthropology. And then I got to a point, and this often happens with book projects, when a lot of things come together, and I felt that nobody really had put together the puzzle of this guy. Here's a grisly explorer. Mm-hmm. You know, these kinds of people don't usually go on to become visionaries and the, you know, most influential scientists of their generation, and found these institutions. And so it really, really was kind of a puzzle for me to figure out, okay, well, what was it about, you know, what held this guy together and why was he such an American original?
Yeah. There's a story you tell right up front. This is in 1890. John Wesley Powell is testifying before this Senate committee. And at this point, he, of course, has returned from his expedition of the canyon. That was several decades before. I'm just trying to imagine him, John, walking into that hearing, because you say he could really capture a room.
So he's not a tall fellow. He's 5'6". He's wearing wool, kind of slouchy suit, but the thing you'd notice right away about him was they had no right arm, no right forearm. And when he would get engaged and active, that's when things would come alive. He had this flash about him, and what would happen, Doug, is his the rest of his right arm would start moving just almost violently, if you can imagine, where he's pacing up. He had this huge energy and this huge curiosity just burned out of him. But you imagine you're watching him as these senators were, as he came up with a whole bunch of maps and other things to talk about this important issues. And the arm starts kind of twitching, and he'd reach back with his left arm around, if you can imagine, it's around his back and kind of subdue the stump of his arm. Yeah. And so you kind of got a sense of that here was this guy, you know, just trying to keep it all contained because he had so much to say, so much passion. He had, you know, he was really something to see.
Mm. Now explain what it is that the members of this Senate Select Committee on Irrigation and Reclamation of Arid Lands, what is it that they wanted to hear from John Wesley Powell?
Well, you know, it does. This kind of sounds boring, you know, reclamation and this. And really what was at hand was really how to talk about the development of the West.
Yeah.
You know, this was this huge land, and after the Civil War, Americans of the East turned to this country that was largely unexplored and largely unknown. There were no novels, there were no photographs, there were no paintings. You know, you imagine that. People were wrestling, okay, well, what do we do with the West? You know, it's this incredible resource, right? Let's do something with it. And there was a feeling, of course, at that time of manifest destiny that America, and still to this day, that America's, you know, destiny lay in going over the continent and developing its resources and, you know, this great vital movement. Mm-hmm. And Powell came in. Then, you know, he was head of the U.S. Geological Survey. He was the most influential scientist kind of his generation.
Yeah.
And he unrolled a very special map and said, wait, guys, as they were all guys in the Senate then, wait. You know, we need to think a little bit more about how we're going to imagine the West, this almost new country, how we're going to develop it, how we're going to think about exploiting its resources. Wait a second. I have some things to say.
It's interesting the way you describe it in the book, as you say, he basically tried to change the American narrative.
Indeed. Indeed. You know, again, like I said, with the whole idea of America, this promise on a hill and this movement west and take in the Gilded Age that would come of this was take what you want and this is your destiny, America. Let's go get it. You know, just don't anybody stand in the way. It's ours to take and here we are. And so what Powell really came to say, well, that's not going to work in the West. It had worked some, you know, pretty well in the East when they were developing lands. They'd give out, you know, to anybody who wanted 168-acre parcel. It's called a quarter section. And if you lived on the land for 5 years, you know, you're an immigrant or whomever, and you made the land profitable, then you could keep it. Kind of part of the American dream. You know, it's this great thing. So as they were beginning to develop the West, you know, that model was still in place. Give them 160 acres. And then Powell came along and said, well, you know, that's not going to work. A, it's too arid out there.
Mm-hmm.
B, you know, just, you know, the water, you know, you're going to get into all kinds of problems with water monopolies and people are going to go bankrupt and get busted. It's going to ruin. And he did feel that's the kind of the Jeffersonian idea of the small farmer, you know, was going to build this country. And he was, after fighting in the Civil War, I mean, he really, really believed he had bled and lost a limb for the idea of America. And he was not going to let, you know, some kind of, you know, ideas of what things should be when the reality on the ground was completely different get in the way of real American prosperity.
But that's not what they wanted to hear.
And
in fact, you say
they
were outraged. It was, I think, the word you use in the book.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just hard to imagine then that you could say anything worse to these, you know, a lot of the Western senators. They were depending on people to come out west and build through taxes their coffers up. And they had bought into this whole dream of the West as this Eden, you know, a garden, you know, that just needed some people. The railroad barons who had been given so much land, you know, they were depending on, you know, their investments playing out and towns and cities developing and things like that. So there were a lot of vested interest who, you know, it was an unpardonable sin. I mean, it's hard to even imagine how strongly they responded. They tried to ruin Powell.
Yeah.
Because they felt he was standing directly in the way of everything they believed in.
We have to take a moment, John, and just mention the parallels for today, because you say that this is still – Powell throws down this gauntlet that you mentioned is still relevant to the time we live in. And if you're trying to imagine, as I am, him laying out these maps, which I want to talk about a little bit later, but basically here he has the science. Here he's laid out this scientific reality of the West for these senators. And he's saying, this is going to pose some limits to what you want. And they just don't want to hear it. And so this idea of hostility to some of these scientific realities, I mean, it's clear the parallels to today. At least that occurred to you, I'm sure.
Absolutely, Doug. I mean, you know, I just see it. It resonates so much. I mean, that was what is so exciting about writing about Powell, was that here he was swimming up against the tide. And as you mentioned, he would have loved PowerPoint presentations. He was a beautiful communicator. You know, I mean, there he was with these maps nobody had ever seen before and these graphs and these reams of data. And he had traveled the West and thought about it and talked to the Indians and talked to the Mormons and talked to settlers and put all of this thing, this incredibly brilliant mind. He put all of this together and he laid it out in a, you know, just very, very straightforward, thoughtful way nonetheless, and that I think is where you find some of the parallels today between climate scientists who are presenting profoundly persuasive data about global climate change and their human responsibility in large part for that, and getting overridden, and so much of what was overriding Powell in that day overrides people today, because I think that a lot of climate scientists and people who believe that are seen by certain people, climate deniers, as really standing in the way, again, of American progress, as really being in the way.
Yeah.
And I can hear Powell in his grave saying, no, 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 I am not in the way of progress. Nobody would ever call Powell an environmentalist. He was saying that the way actually to our goals of progress, to be the greatest American nation, to be the shining example on a hill, was very much listening to the land and the resources and thinking, okay, what do we have and how do we work with it and how do we work with it sustainably? So he basically kind of is inventing the concept of sustainability. And he said it's going to be not going to help in any way for anybody to push the land, push water resources, put people on land that are going to turn to drought and their crops are going to wither. There's no point in doing that. It's just going to result in ruin and tragedy, and that's going to be a terrible, terrible blow to American democracy. So what he was saying is, no, let's listen. Let's pay attention. And he wasn't being negative in his mind, but people thought he was. And the parallels are just, as you said, resonant.
Well, it's important to say, as you say, later in the book, he was no tree-hugging conservationist. He saw – talk a little bit about this. He saw Western Rivers, you say, as a plumbing system, basically ready to help build the glorious American future. I mean, he, as you say, was no enemy of development, but he thought it just had to be done properly.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's such an interesting character, Doug, because, you know, developers have claimed, you know, he is their kind of guiding light. Environmentalists have claimed him. And he's really hard to pigeonhole on that, because he did say, you know, he wasn't opposed to putting on dams on rivers and, you know, things like that. I mean, but I do believe that he would be horrified about 800 and 900 foot dams and the fact that every river in the American West is dammed at least once and multiple times. He would be shocked that the Colorado River, which used to flow through Mexico into the sea, now hits the Mexican border and dries up, that it's the most contested and litigated water source on the planet. So he, I don't think was seeing how things could have really got out of hand the way they did, you know, today and over the last, 50 years.
Yeah. Let's back up and talk about the world in which John Wesley Powell was born and raised. His life was very much defined by the faith of his father, Joseph Powell. In fact, he names his firstborn son after the founder of Methodism, John Wesley. And you say he pledged the child to carry on the work of the Lord. Talk a little bit about this part of the story, how he's raised in this very religious household, and it kind of shapes the way he sees the world.
Absolutely, Doug. So his father and his mother come over from England via Wales, and they have just been caught up in this new Methodism, and they are ministers. And they come, you know, with so many other immigrants to claim a part of the new world and to really live into their, you know, their dreams, and take a huge chance, as those immigrants did. They moved to, you know, Western New York, the burned over district, where so much was happening in terms of new religions were happening and all of that. And they had one son who died, but the next son who, you know, so the eldest son, really, John Wesley Powell, he named for John Wesley, you know, the Methodist founder. And that was the biggest statement he would make, you know, one of the biggest statements he would make in his life. His firstborn son, he was convinced and devoted to that he would become, you know, carry on John Wesley's, you know, kind of doctrine and live into religion, become a minister, and really, you know, carry on why his father, you know, came to the New World to really, really live into this. And so there's a tension because, as we find out, John Wesley, young John Wesley, was not interested in that course. He got snuck into, got really just infected with this whole idea. What was happening right then was natural history and geology with these incredible sciences. And he got sucked into that instead.
Yeah. Well, we should mention Powell was an evangelical Methodist, and Joseph Powell's father. And in those days, one of the defining conflicts of America, of course, was where you stood on slavery. And most of his fellow Methodists supported the idea of slavery. Of course, Joseph Powell did not. And this sets up this conflict that was also defining in the life of John Wesley Powell, his son.
So Joseph brings his young family, including his young son, John Wesley, and they moved down to southern Ohio and to Jackson, Ohio, and it's right near the Ohio River, and that, as we know, was the bright line, as they called it, between Kentucky, a slaveholding state, and Ohio, which was a free state.
Yeah.
And there, Joseph Powell, John Wesley Powell's father, got bitten by, you know, those areas of frontiers create incredible tension and innovation and violence as slaves were escaping and all these things into the Ohio, but they were considered property, so Ohio residents were obligated to return them. And so set up these incredible, and this is the 1830s, 1840s.
Yeah.
So Joseph Wesley living, you know, leaning into his Wesleyanism, you know, his Methodism, says, well, no, this is just not right in any way, shape, or form. He becomes an abolitionist. And this, and abolitionism means not only get rid of slavery, but that the races should be equal. And it was almost the latter that was the most scary thing to a lot of whites, right? So, and abolitionism then was a bad word. I mean, it was just a fringe group, and Ralph Waldo Emerson called them angry bigots. You know, this was, you know, right, this was crazy, you know, and they were really a divisive element. And there he was, you know, he was preaching, he was going out on these long horseback rides to talk about it. There was I discovered in my research this large African-American community of freed slaves right near Jackson, and it was a hub of the Underground Railroad, which has just begun to start there, right? So Joseph, you know, was a part of that, you know, and his young son met the leading abolitionists in the country who had come through this little town and saw this firsthand of these just terrible things where slave catchers would come in and kill people who were holding slaves and take people out of, you know, out of their homes. It culminated when John Wesley was about 10 years old and in his school. And the whole community there was a lot of Scots-Irish, you know, and they were feisty. They didn't own slaves. They didn't like that idea, but they didn't like people telling them what to do. And they certainly didn't think that blacks and whites should be equal. I mean, my gosh, a black man marrying a white woman. I mean, what could happen? Right. And so it was a very hostile environment. One day after school, I discovered this. I mean, I think this is so formative in Powell's life. There are kids waiting for him. And a lot of the kids weren't just kids. They were young men. And, you know, they started baiting him, telling him to go back to Africa if he liked black so much. And then they pulled out stones and they started, you know, this is so biblical, Doug, so biblical. Yeah. You know, they started winging and hitting him and hurting him. And he ran away, you know, and back home, you know. And his parents pulled him from school. But there was that experience of being forced to be an outsider. And to be, you know, just so clearly not on the inside track. And it was such a formative experience and gave him not just an empathy for people who were the other, which would he would later study American Indians and Mormons all that. But it would really give him, a fresh look at the things around him. He just didn't take things for granted.
Interesting, he doesn't even mention Jackson, Ohio in his writings. And when the family was driven away by violence eventually, he never went back to Jackson. So the idea—
Never wrote about it.
Yeah, never wrote about it. Lingered on the edges of his consciousness for the rest of his life, you say, that experience.
Absolutely, remembering those angry faces. Profound.
I want to talk about the science part, because this is, I think, kind of delightful. He finds a friend. He finds refuge in this museum, this kind of odd museum created by a man by the name of George Crookham. And Crookham becomes seems like an important figure at that time of his life, kind of a father figure and a companion to this young kid.
Absolutely. So, you know, we were talking about, Doug, of course, that, you know, his father was this, was very religious and wanted to make sure that Powell, you know, young Powell was following along that. And so he didn't like all this stuff about his, you know, John Wesley's Powell. He would bring home some arrowheads or a skeleton he found in the woods. And his dad didn't want anything to do with all that. That was just not something that you paid attention to. And so when he was taken out of school after that, you know, the stoning thing, he was put under the custody of George Crookham, and they called him Big George because he weighed 400 pounds and just an incredible fellow. I mean, somebody called him the Samuel Johnson of the woods. And, you know, he could read papers upside down. He could identify species. So he's kind of this really odd duck. He happened to also be an abolitionist and a friend of John Wesley Powell's father, obviously. But what this guy did was he encouraged this young boy who had so many questions about the way the world was and what happened and why. And they found these fossils of megafauna, like woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers and all that. And it really encouraged it. And right at that moment, geology was just, it was kind of like the particle physics of today. You know, geology was just breaking open such new, incredible things, right? Because people generally thought, you know, kind of that the Bible said that the world was about 6,000 years old. Yeah. And here geology is saying, well, no, it's many millions of years old. And then Darwin comes in and says, okay, well, we got that much time. Look what happened to evolution. And then things start changing in society. It's this really, and there was young Powell with, and then Crookham knew all these geologists and they'd go out on these carts, you know, and of course they'd be going to, I think, seeing, you know, escaped slaves too, but they would also be talking about geology and natural history and what that meant. And it just, you know, he just landed in this place. And of course, the kid was just electrified by the conversations and what he saw.
I love the idea of him. You mentioned when he was young, he would, his real education was in fields and forests, but also in rivers. He spent a lot of time on rivers, which makes a lot of sense when you think about what he learned, you know, in the Colorado River eventually. But this idea of rivers giving him scientific insights or freedom, I think I just wanted you to mention something about that, because that seemed important too.
Oh, wow. What a story that is, too. I mean, remember then, we're really not, you know, obviously no automobiles, no railroads going across the country. The Erie Canal is coming along and stuff like that. But what a young adventurous person of any note did, Abraham Lincoln did this, I mean, you name it, was they got on a little boat in the Mississippi River and they went down the Mississippi River. It was just this highway where you learned about America and commerce and you saw everything. I mean, it was just this really alluring thing. So John Wesley Powell kind of followed that too, and he had already begun collecting things, and he collected mollusks, you know, shells, right? Kind of freshwater clams and, you know, you name it. And it took him all on the Illinois River, all, you know, just Ohio River, the Mississippi, all over the place in this little boat, you know, by himself on this incredible adventure. And he ultimately, from that, not only whetted some of his curiosities, but he built one of the world's most incredible collection of freshwater mollusks, right? And that gained him entry. Gained him the gravitas that he had not been able to get to in college because his father wouldn't pay for any college aside from a religious institution, and he was not going to have any part of that.
Yeah. So we have the scientific part. Let's talk about the part that the Civil War, what that brings to the disposition of John Wesley Powell. He's 27 years old when the Civil War begins. A big believer in Lincoln and a believer that the Union needed to be held together. Again, I think this is his idea of, this may have been his upbringing in Methodism, that there is some grand purpose here. And he was a believer in that. And it's interesting, he comes to serve with General Grant, U.S. Grant, drawn to Grant because, unlike some of the other leaders he encountered, Grant was unassuming and kind of humble. And I wanted you to say something about that, because I found that really interesting, that he did fancy himself a populist. And I guess that's what he liked about Grant, was he was a soldier for the men, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, and really before Grant really hit his stride, you know, they encountered each other at this small town and Powell had decided that he was going to kind of figure out, because he just was always in movement, right? You can imagine this guy always kind of, you know, he just didn't want to be a soldier. He wanted to develop artillery and batteries in this little town. And Grant came through this little town and saw Powell, and Powell took him around on horseback for an hour or two, and they looked at different battlements. And I think he was taken with this young man's energy. Yeah. And they developed a relationship that would last a lifetime. And and as you mentioned, there was this wonderful kind of kinship, both from a, you know, kind of this Ohio Midwest, this idea that, you know, and I think Powell took a lot of kind of cues from Grant, too, about his leadership and the lack of ostentatiousness and just the way that that Grant, you know, comported himself. I mean, just the fact that he and Grant rode alone around for a while without a lot of aides. You know, just a lot of Civil War generals had this just huge retinue following them around. You know, here was Grant with his slouch hat and private's coat, you know, on riding around. And I think that really impressed young Powell.
Yeah. You read about the battle, of course, where Powell loses his right arm. It was one of the war's fiercest actions, you say. He raises his right arm to signal his gunners to start firing. And that's when he's hit. I guess we don't have to remind people there wasn't a whole lot in the way of antiseptic or antibiotics or surgery. I mean, if something like this happened where your forearm is shattered, I mean, you could pretty easily die.
Oh, absolutely. And as people did. I mean, you have to remember, so we are in Tennessee at Shiloh, and there's this huge engagement, of course, between the Confederates and the Union. And a big part of that was this area called the Hornet's Nest, where it just was just an impossibly huge number of troops concentrated. So And really, really the just one of the bloodiest places, certainly up until then, and in the war. And what happened as a result of that, and as you mentioned, you know, he raised his army, he was head of an artillery battery, and a Confederate mini-ball hit his wrist. And, you know, back then they were shooting mini-balls that were of the soft lead. You know, they didn't go, you know, not a lot of calibers. They didn't go very fast. So what it did, it kind of splatted out on his bone and then just kind of ripped down his arm. And he was taken back lines and miraculously got back there. And the Union, as well as the Confederates, were looking at – they didn't have enough surgeons. And the techniques, as you mentioned, of course, with any kind of sulfa drugs or antibiotics, you know, were not known. You know, people were dying left and right. He had a pretty good surgeon, though, who had actually had some surgery experience, but they still had no technique. So you often see the pictures of John Wesley Powell, this kind of scowl, grim look on his face, and he was in pain for the rest of his life. I mean, they basically just kind of severed everything and moved the skin over. You know, they didn't really do anything to the nerves. I mean, so it's terrible neuralgic pain and all that you know, that bothered him terribly for the rest of his life.
You also mentioned, and you referring to this earlier, that when he got excited, that arm would start to engage. And you say he didn't call attention to it very often, but it became a part of his, this is how you put it in the book, his functioning adult makeup. I guess this was one of the ways he expressed himself, was with that stump, I guess.
I have to remember back then that physical deformities were kind of equated with mental instabilities and mental retardation, all kinds of disabled things, you know, were looked on under the eyes of God, most people believed, as you were not a whole person. So back then, you either kind of succumbed to this fatalism, you know, and sat on the porch of a storefront and had people pat you on the shoulder, you know, kind of in a pathetic way. Or there were only a few of these folks, somebody like Powell, who just, you know, I think used it as a, you know, as a real motivating force that, you know, he was not going to take charity. He was not going to take handouts. He was proud that he had bled for the Union, and that his mutilation was actually a badge of honor. And he rode that into, you know, if you can imagine it, doing one of the most daring, physically demanding expeditions in American history.
That's John Ross. His book is The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio inviting you to go see our latest short film at Radio West Films. This is the animated story of Mormon pioneer Margaret Daglish. Walked to Utah with a handcart, suffered incredible hardship, and came out of it a survivor. The historian Will Bagley tells the story. The Utah animator Ainsley Romero brings it to life. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian John Ross. We're talking about his new book, The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. What is it that brings him to the West first? Say something about that, if you would, John.
Sure. You know, so after the war, he gets offered some political positions, but he wants to go back. He wants to teach, and he's very interested in the natural history world, of course. And and the West is this, again, like we talked about, this big kind of unknown. And so what he does basically is he puts together some of the first college summer expeditions to the West, signs these kids up, takes them out West. They go into Denver and they go into the Middle Park and they collect. And part of his idea was that he was going to fund a lot of this, his explorations out there, by collecting natural history and Indian artifacts, grizzly bear skulls and hides and bird species and Indian baskets and send them back to the East to universities for their museums, because this was such an exciting, you know, new, yeah. you know, the West was so yeah. new. Right then, he was beginning to really suss the West out, to meet some really interesting kind of mountain men, and then to really start cogitating this whole idea that there was one last section of the American continent, mm-hmm. one last jigsaw piece that had been unexplored. And that was a 100-mile by 300-mile section in the Colorado Plateau. And you got to remember Colorado Plateau, and this is Arizona, parts of Utah, yeah. and it's high. It's the second highest plateau in the world, second only to one in Tibet, right? And it's, yeah. and as we know, this section is just now we know, of course, that he didn't. Was that this held Zion and Bryce and Capitol Reef and, of course, the Grand Canyon, which he would name. But it was an incredibly inhospitable place to get through. I mean, you couldn't walk across it. I mean, there's these huge chasms. So Powell decided, okay, I'm going to go through this on boats, and I'm going to do it as a scientific expedition. As a geologist, it was an extraordinary opportunity. I mean, the Grand yeah. Canyon is the most incredible opportunity to study Earth's history anywhere in the world. And here he was like a kid in the candy store thinking, wow, if I can get in and see this, I can map the river, I can see what it's all about. I mean, this is pretty exciting. Of course, on the other hand, even people like Charles Fremont, really hardcore explorers, and you know, thought this was suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, just they didn't know if there were any waterfalls. It could end everything mm-hmm. in 2 seconds. The Indians were reporting that the water for miles on time would go underground and come back up. I mean, there were probably no way to get out. There are huge deserts around the side of it, even if you could scale the huge cliffs. I mean, there were so many you know, things that said no, you know, but Powell was a pretty creative, innovative type, and he mm-hmm. had some ideas about how he could make it through.
One of the things that you write about, and this is interesting, is that after being on the river something like 12 days or something like that, Powell writes, it is a dark portal to a region of gloom, the gateway through which we are to enter on our voyage of exploration. But in very dark terms, something about the canyon really troubled him. He saw something dark in it. Would you just say something about that? I found that really interesting, that ominous sense that he had about the canyon as well.
Yeah, it was an interesting one in on the Green River in this Lodore Canyon, you know, and going along, and, you know, he knew something was coming up. And these walls, they shoot up, you know, over 1,000 feet tall. So you can imagine that. And it gets dark in there. And the water starts, you know, just roiling and riffling and just getting, you know, really, really nasty. And, you know, nothing is really growing along the sides. And it's this world of rock and water. And at that point, he had kind of was, once he entered into that, nobody was going to be able to help him.
Yeah.
And he was committed. So that was the point. And I think he, you know, he as the expedition leader realized that this was an extraordinary risk. And there were pretty good odds that they weren't going to make it out at all. So I think he kind of looked that in the eye. I mean, he was kind of a realist on that stuff too.
Yeah. It's interesting that also that what it is that we understood at the time about what had shaped that massive canyon and, or any of those formations there. And you say the geology of the time explained the creation of the canyons with this theory of catastrophism?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was that? Because Powell almost fairly quickly starts to make some sense of what's really going on. But talk about this part.
Well, right. So as we were talking about, of course, geology was, you know, this new thing, right? And So a real question in this, really where the real argument was among people of science and et cetera, was this thing between catastrophism and uniformitarianism, a real mouthful.
Yeah.
But as you can imagine, right, catastrophism, you think of Noah's flood. It's really more about, you know, big volcanoes and big, huge changes, and that's why we have the Earth the way it was. And it was kind of one of the prevailing, more conventional ideas about how the Earth formed. But as these new ideas coming out, and this guy Charles Lyell, a very famous geologist, wrote a big thing on uniformitarianism. And if all you have to know about that word is if you think of something as uniform, he was beginning to say, and this was beginning to percolate, was that things often did. Yeah, you had some catastrophic things, but most changes came gradually over time, over long and long and long periods of time. So where you have a river that is, you know, moving along over millions and millions of years, it could carve, you know, a deep canyon, right? Mm-hmm. So Powell was very much a kind of understanding that, you know, that that these great mountains were as much formed by little tiny raindrops as anything else, you know, that were eroding, and that what they were looking at. It was a hard thing for people to understand that rain in the dry, arid West in these lands of canyon was one of the real formative forces shaping the West. And so these were all these things coming. And right, so he goes in and he you know, they're going down the river, and they come to this open area, and then the river goes right smack through the middle of this mountain, just cuts it like it's a cleaver, right? And if you think of water in a sandbox, you know, what water does, it kind of always usually takes the easiest route. And he saw that the river should have just kind of hit this wall and moseyed on, you know, but it went smack right through, and this was a puzzle for him. And so he began to play with these ideas that would eventually become the science that he kind of would really contribute to, geomorphology, yeah, which is how the Earth's surface forms. And he found that there was a combination of these mountains were being upthrust, and yet rivers at the same time were downcutting. So you could actually have a case where a river came in long, long after the you know, something was upthrust, you know, or a river could come in first, and that there were, so rivers could change directions. Mm-hmm. So he really began, I mean, if you think about it, it's like this incredible three-dimensional puzzle. But there were clues in all of these forces that he was seeing right there as to the way the Earth had developed. And it was just excited him very much.
I want to get back to the time around the hearing that we were talking about earlier, where this Senate committee, led by a remarkable figure, I wish we had time to talk more about William Stewart, a senator from Nevada. He was a fascinating character. But, of course, Powell, he's kind of his arch nemesis in some ways. They go on this trip west together, and their relationship deteriorates, and you lay this out in the book. But one of the things you write about is the kind of the competing views between Powell and Senator Stewart. Stewart's view, you say, is that the desert could be redeemed. And you say everyone wanted to believe that. Hearts ached to believe that. And the way then they saw what Powell was saying, like, you know, hold on, guys, we need to limit this. We have to understand the realities of geology and the realities of water. They saw him standing in the way of progress. And Powell, you say, became a scapegoat for all that stood in the way of American prosperity. Talk a little bit about this, because these are the real two competing ideas that Powell is now confronting in these hearings.
Absolutely. So William Stewart was, you know, senator of newly formed Nevada. And, you know, on one hand, can't blame him. He was really standing up for his constituents in Nevada and for encouraging people to come out and participate in this grand experiment of America. But Powell felt ultimately that he wasn't listening to the limits that the land put on some of his rhetoric. And so Powell called him out on that. Yeah. And Senator Stewart was a very, you know, charismatic, colorful, bigger-than-life kind of guy, you know, who commanded an incredible amount of influence and attention in the Senate. What he was really selling and what he was really representing as a senator was this belief that the West could be something just really incredible, that it actually was a place that, you know, could be a garden, that really had this possibility of being a real Eden, and being the real, real epicenter of where American development, of who America was, you know, where that all would happen. And so you imagine these two kind of titanic figures clashing in the Senate over these kind of competing views. And, you know, Powell, you know, just got the worst of it for a lot of reasons. There were senators getting into fist fights about this in the Senate. You know, I mean, you think irrigation and reclamation, you think, oh, well, that's a real snoozer. But boy, this was right at the heart. This was the pulse of who America was going to become, what it was going to become, and how it was going to do that, and how this great Western land was going to be integrated. How can we possibly integrate that? The East and the West, they're like two different countries. How do we begin to do that? And Powell had these very strong ideas, which, you know, I argue pretty much survived, you know, and are validated today. But you know, then, and that's the role of visionaries often, is to come up with some hard truths and talk about that, but not be really celebrated in their day.
Yeah. Would you say something a little bit about these commonwealths? He envisioned water being controlled by these commonwealths, and he was inspired by the Mormons in some ways about this. And the significance of this idea is that these local owners, they would not trash it because they had the self-interest involved. And that the federal government, he believed, wouldn't be a major participant, not if, once this thing kind of worked itself out. Just say something. I know we're running out of time, but John, say something about that.
Well, yeah, he was very clear about that. I mean, he's often presented as this federal bureaucrat, in which often, you know, he was. But he, you know, he said in his writing, federal government hands off. You know, I mean, yes, the government could come in and do some small damming projects and get things going and all like that. But then they were, you know, needed to get out of the way, because the only way for this kind of sustainability he was talking about was really to keep water in watersheds. You know, you'd be aghast that we're shipping, you know, water by canals 300 or 400 miles over mountains now. Mm-hmm. I mean, he thought that that would just only lead, as it has, to a lot of litigation and difficulties and problems. He wanted the water to be tied legally to the land. And for local decisions to be made by local people on the ground about how that, you know, so he was really, in a way, he was really beginning to talk about the tragedy of the commons, which would, you know, just happen much, much later, that would be coined much later, for the idea that, you know, if you have a common resource like water, or a fisheries, you know, fish out in the sea or something. But if everybody's kind of going at it and it's a common thing, then often you find yourself, you know, wrecking that resource.
Yeah.
And I think that you mentioned the Mormons, and I think that that's where, you know, he really got a lot of sense, because the Mormons, of course, had moved out to a very, very hostile, arid environment. And really one of the only ways they had survived was turning some of their ideas of community and communal living toward their natural resources. So the water was held kind of in common trust. So he was kind of looking at that. And there are parts of Powell talking about these commonwealth communities that get very idealistic and a little fuzzy and not realistic. But on the other hand, there are just really such solid pieces of this thing. Bioregionalism, all of these things now that people are beginning to talk about and institute in an interesting way about this guy who was talking about it 150 years ago.
He didn't get everything right. You mentioned the areas that he misjudged, didn't quite. But a lot of his ideas have played out today. And one of the things you mentioned, and I'll ask you about this finally, even though he saw the West through these, other people saw the West through these rose-colored glasses, he wasn't taken in by that necessarily, but he was taken by the land. He was taken by the culture. And you say finally that he wasn't asking for reverence for the land, as you put it. What he was asking for was humility regarding it.
Well, you really put your finger right on it. I mean, when it comes down to it, it was, and I think that that probably came a little bit out of his, you know, his upbringing as the son of a Methodist preacher, that there was a deep responsibility and a humility to pay attention to what the land, what the climate, what the water, what they were telling us, and that it was our responsibility So this is really where the idea of stewardship comes in, the idea of sustainability. And I don't want to take a man out of the 19th century and make him a 21st century, you know, that he was pushing all the right buzzwords. He wasn't. You know, he got a lot wrong. But what he was doing was framing the questions and framing the, you know, the discussions and identifying things way ahead of his time. And really would set up discussions that would not happen for a long time until, you know, I mean, the you know, one of the big manifestations of what happened, he died in 1902, and he'd been talking about you got to pay attention to the land or things, bad things happen. In the 1930s, Washingtonians in Washington, D.C. woke up in 1934, spring 1935, to these huge dust clouds, and it begrimed people's buildings, and you couldn't see the sun, and it kind of... people were a little panicked. Well, it turned out that that was the topsoil from Kansas and Nebraska and Oklahoma that because of too much plowing and too much of indiscriminate development of the land had blown off. You know, the entire topsoil of the whole region had blown off, and a good amount of it had blown 1,000 miles east. I mean, if you can imagine. So that instituted... you know, a lot of people saying, okay, well, we got to plant trees. We got to be more discriminating about how we develop and all like that. But this was what Powell generally, you know, was had been talking about, was coming to pass. So, you know, I think today, you know, and then here I have to step out of being an historian and saying this is my opinion. But, you know, I think he today, if he was back today, he would be at the, you know, leading charge of global climate change saying, look, you know, let's pay attention. What is the planet telling us? He didn't know about global climate change, but he today would have said, well, let's look at the data. Let's look at what we're doing. Let's look at the relationships and then let's act accordingly. Let's be stewards. Let's be sustainable about this.
John Ross. His book is The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. He joined us for this from the studios of NPR in Washington. John, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Holly Vasek. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.